consideration is...
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Floor Leader.
Privilege to the floor first. Just an update on our chairman of agriculture. He's doing fine. I saw a little video from him. He's going to be in the hospital for a day or two longer, so maybe he'll be back by the end of the week. He wants to make sure we keep things moving along in an orderly manner, and he's listening to us right now. So, Chairman, we want you back here as soon as possible.
Floor Leader Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The general file is the same as the list you got this morning. We're currently on House Bill 119. Then we're going to, the next five bills will be 87, 147, 101, and 126. So we're staying on the list for the rest of the day.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 119. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 119, introduced by Representative Kirkbride. Senior Citizen Districts, Use of Revenues, an act relating to senior citizen service districts. Mr. Chairman, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred House Bill 119, Senior Citizen Districts, Use of Revenues, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendment. Ayes, Representatives Barlow, Clem, Dayton, Garrew, Hallinan, Halverson, McGuire, and Sweeney. Excused, Representative Lone. Signed, Representative Barlow, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Barlow?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report. It does so with the recommendation that House Bill 119 do pass. I also move the Standing Committee Amendment. And for the explanation of the bill and the Standing Amendment, I will turn over to the fine Chairman Kirkbride.
Chairman Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 119, Senior Citizen District's Use of Revenues. So let me set the table for you a little bit. Here as we do the Standing Committee Amendment, I guess. First, it was just almost a technical insertion by the committee on page 2, line 5. Limiting the kind of the definition of services to just the services discussed in the subsection that we're going to get into in more depth here in a moment. So I would move the Standing Committee Amendment at this time.
Question. You have heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we're into the world of special districts, which might be our first bill on that in the last 10 days. Talking in particular about senior citizen districts, a little about those, since you might be unfamiliar with them because there's only 4 of them in the state. Typically, they're countywide. They can levy up to 2 mills, which in my county means they can generate up to about $300,000 a year. They're renewed every 2 years. They're overseen by 5 trustees, and the trustee's job really is just one thing. It's to remit the money that is collected from the taxpayers onto the service providers. As I said, there's 4 districts. There's one in my county. There's one in the least populous county of the state, and there are actually 2 up in the county on the northern tier of counties, which is sets on the west side of the big, beautiful mountains up there. So if you'll go to page 2, we'll get into the meat of the bill. I'll just read those couple lines at the top. The revenues collected on the tax levy authorized by 1850-110 shall be remitted by the county treasurer to the district to a separate account and shall be used solely for senior citizen programs. So what does solely for senior citizen programs mean? That can be kind of ambiguous. Your well-meaning district board member has somebody come to them with some sort of proposal. Let's do this or that. with our $300,000, well, it's a senior citizen program, might sound pretty good. And it's possible and has happened in our experience that the money will sort of get diverted into a less than essential purpose. And that's really what this bill is trying to avoid. So the two key paragraphs are Romanet 2, beginning on page 10. It says the legitimate purposes, and we're kind of trying to focus this, rein this in on the essential purposes. So the legitimate purposes for the money from the district are, two, the expansion of existing senior citizen centers to provide programs such as nutrition, health, in-home services, socialization, or transportation. And in your county, there's apt to be one sort of all-comprehensive senior program that works on all those kind of things. So the money could go to one of those comprehensive programs, or down in paragraph three, it could go sort of a la carte to different types of programs that do just one of those things. You know, there's that popular nonprofit that drives around town at lunchtime and takes meals to people's houses. That would be a legitimate expenditure if you don't have a comprehensive program and just have pieces and parts program around your community. In that paragraph three, it talks about the services administered through the aging division, and those services really parallel what we talked about in paragraph two. So they'd be for nutrition, for health, for in-home services, for socialization, for transportation. So that's basically the two ways that your board can direct their money. But either way they do it, whether they do it in a package or whether they do it a la carte, they're going to be giving the money to essential services, and that's really what the bill was about. It doesn't have to be the comprehensive, but we would like the money directed for core services. That's the experience of our special district for seniors, and there's 19 other, 20 other counties out there that may someday have a district like this, and it would be good to have the money directed for what the taxpayers intended for it go for in the first place. So that's the bill, Mr. Chairman, and I'll stand for questions, and if there are none, I'll call for the question.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Barlow's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it does so with the recommendation that bill number 119 do pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House bill 119 has passed the committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is House bill 87. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 87, introduced by Representative Ponnell. Return of victims' property held as evidence. An act relating to the Victim and Witness Bill of Rights. Mr. Chairman, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 87, Return of victims' property held as evidence, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendment. Ayes, Representatives Baker, Beitman, Jennings, Kirkbride, Olson, Pelkey, Ponnell, Salazar, Winters, signed Representative Kirkbride, Chairman.
Chairman Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee of the whole rise to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 87 do pass. And I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee amendments. To present the amendments, our good colleague from House District 11.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill, just to kind of give you a little bit of background here on why the amendment exists outside of the is coming out of the committee. What this bill does is it creates a statutory period of 60 days to return property held in evidence lockers, and ultimately we're overwhelmed in our evidence lockers. But all the amendment does is provide for a process of notice before that property is returned. So what the bill does is say that a prosecutor must return property in his possession within 60 days, unless, and as you read through the bill, there's some exceptions on why we might want to hold on to that evidence. If there hasn't been a proper analysis of the evidence, or we want to physically introduce it at trial, we're going to hold on to it. But all the amendment does is say, well, hey, look, if the prosecutor is going to return the property, before he or she does that, that prosecutor needs to send out a notice to defense counsel and allow them 20 days essentially to respond. And this makes sense because while I believe wholeheartedly that our prosecutors operate with the utmost good intentions and certainly with society's best interests in mind at all times, the amendment simply puts a safeguarding procedure in place. And it's not that uncommon inside criminal procedure and inside civil procedure. Both systems are built on notice requirements to each party. No party gets to do anything in a lawsuit without the other party knowing that something is happening. And that's all we're doing here. So it doesn't really make any substantive change to the bill. We're just making sure that a defense counsel has an ability to be heard if they want to object to the evidence being returned. And with that, I would stand for questions on the amendment.
Question having been called. You have heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Question having been called. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say no. The Standing Committee Amendment number one has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Chairman Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For explanation of the bill, I turn it over to our good colleague from House District 52.
Representative Pinnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I want to thank my colleague in the judiciary that brought the amendment forward, explained it rather well, and I look at it as a friendly amendment. So, you know, this bill is basically all about the victims. It's about trying to get their property back to them in a timely manner. This bill doesn't talk about aggravated crimes where you have property that is going to stay in evidence, basically, I say, indefinitely. But what this does is it gives the victims the right to get their personal property back, such as tools, jewelry, cash, things that currently what we utilize now is photographs. Photographs is generally what is taken over to court. Much of this evidence that we have in our evidence vaults, which is getting to be a problem, because in my area where I'm from, they had to add on to the evidence vault because of the fact that we have so much evidence that is either waiting for court or is there because the court is down the road many months or even years, that a lot of that evidence could be released. And when we wait for a long period of time, sometimes you can't find the victims in these crimes. They move on. So, it's a pretty simple bill that it allows the victim to not be victimized twice. It tries to get his property back in a timely manner, 60 days, and it's not telling the prosecutor that he has to release this evidence. If it's pertinent to the case and they need it in court, we'll hold it. But if it's not, and there's many cases out there where we have this evidence come in where we have no defendant, we have no suspect, and so it basically gets back to the prosecutor to have him come over, take a look at this evidence, and if he feels that it can be returned without prejudice on the case, then it'll happen. So I'll stand for any questions on the bill.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Kirkbride's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that bill number 87 do pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 87 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 147. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 147, introduced by Representative Gray. Release of arrested persons under the influence, an act relating to criminal procedure. Mr. Chairman, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 147, release of arrested persons under the influence, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that do pass with the following amendment. Ayes, Representatives Baker, Biteman, Jennings, Kirkbride, Olson, Pannell, Salazar, Winters, excused, Representative Pelkey. Signed, Representative Kirkbride, Chairman.
Chairman Kirkbride, what is your pleasure?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 147 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the standing committee amendments, which I will explain. And the standing committee amendment basically deals with three issues in the bill. So let's look on page 2 on line 18, and there's a key percentage in there which will be elucidated in a few moments. But we moved that key percentage from 0.08 down to 0%. So that was our first thing we did on the standing committee amendment. Then down on line 21, we took out the words in conformity with this subsection and went over on page 4 and moved that whole paragraph 5 into that spot in the bill. In the process of doing that, we eliminated all of page 3, which seemed superfluous for various reasons to the bill as the discussion went on. And then we finally on page 4 changed the effective date to an effective immediately date. That's what the standing committee about. I'll stand for questions or call for the question. Oh, we have a customer.
Representative Greer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question for the committee that brought the standing committee amendment. So if someone's arrested under this, that means their BAC was above the 0.8%. They've been in custody, and if their BAC is coming down and they're not drinking anything while they're in custody, isn't their BAC continuing to go down? So my question is why go to the 0%? Why isn't it something a little less, unless the intent is make sure you incarcerate people for longer than need be? So I just like an explanation of that.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, this is interesting. Actually, what we learned is that your BAC doesn't necessarily go down immediately, because your BAC could actually be rising while you're tested. And so when they get in, what we actually found was that it's often true that the BAC rises at least to a certain point. It's pretty negligible and minimal, but that's probably mostly beside the point, because I think the impetus of the good representative's question is why do we bring it down to zero? And I think the purpose of the law, or the bill, is to make sure that our detention facilities aren't releasing individuals who have alcohol in their blood, period. And so the committee's thoughts on this issue was that we want to make sure that we're releasing individuals with no blood, with no alcohol in their blood content, that a 0.08 isn't necessarily the safe zone for release. And what we found through testimony in the committee is that our detention centers already do this. In fact, the judge's policies are not to release an individual until they're at a zero. And so what we're actually doing is codifying judicial precedents in the state.
Representative Gray, are you speaking on the amendment? Representative Connolly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question for the bringer of the amendment, bringing it down to zero. So what's your, I guess, a point of information from you. How long does it take to go from a 0.09 down to a zero? And why don't we want someone to be picked up, honestly, and keep them in detention for hours?
Representative Pinnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In answer to the one question, I don't have the exact time frame as how far, if you're at a point 09, 009, not 09, boy, you'd be in trouble. But there's a certain amount of time that it does take. It takes, you're looking at hours from that level to go down to zeros. The other issue that sometimes when they're coming in, they're not going down at that point. It depended on the they may be starting to rise on their blood alcohol level. So it's not always, when they first take that first test, it may be an issue where they're starting to go up. So this practice of zeros is a standard practice amongst many agencies throughout the state through policy. They don't allow individuals out of jail until they blow zeros. Basically, what this does is codify it and put it into statute, and it works much better that way. So, if there's any other questions, I'd be more than happy to answer.
Representative Greer.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on that last point, I guess I realize when some people are arrested in this situation that their BAC may be climbing. But if you're not going to release them until they're below a 0.08, again, that means they reached the 0.08 and climbed and then were coming back down unless you pre-arrested them, assuming that. So, that argument to me doesn't make sense. Because either you arrest them at an 0.08 and then they go up and then you wait till they come back down to a 0.08. So hopefully I'm explaining that correctly. Because I do understand there are people who are arrested and their BAC goes up, unless you've arrested them before they got to that point in time. So that explanation doesn't make sense to me. So that's...
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in response to a couple points here, we had a situation in the county in the center of our state a couple years ago where someone was arrested for DUI, was released to someone else. Someone picked him up. They signed a hold harmless, and then they went back to the bar and got behind the wheel and hit someone, and it was a really awful situation. And so this bill is in response to that. Now, out of that incident came the policy that individuals are not released until they blow a zero. So we're saying now that we're going to codify that policy into statute, and that's what the amendment does. Now, if you had it at 0.08, the original wording of the bill said that it doesn't preclude having a standard lower than that, but at the same time, this amendment says it's going to be zero, and that's what we're going to have in statute.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the question I would have is, one more for information. Alcohol affects different people differently, and it's going to not only are they going to reach, some people reach 0.08 sooner than others, but coming down from that that level with some people might take a while. I think I'm going back to college days. I think I had some friends that were 2 days out before they sobered up very much. I need an education. How long might they be in jail till it's zero?
Representative Gray.
Well, again, this thank you, Mr. Chairman. This policy has been in place here for a couple years, and I'm not sure we directly asked that in the testimony, but it appeared that in most cases that this played out overnight. But I'm not an expert about how long it would be. But this policy is already in place, so if there were huge problems in administering it, I think we would see it by now.
Representative Pinnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In answer to the question, if the individual, he can only be held in jail a certain amount of time. He will go before the court if we're holding him in jail, or him or her. But the court does not want to see an individual that's under the influence. So those tests, that law enforcement does now, all it does is show when they come to zeros, and they can usually just release them. They can kick them out the door, but it's only until they blow zeros. And as I said, that currently happens in a lot of the departments. I'm not saying all. I can't say it happens in every agency or every detention facility. But if they're not released, there's a list of inmates that goes over to the court every day, and that judge is going to want to see this individual. And if he doesn't, he's going to want to know why. So there's no, they're not going to stay there indefinitely. And not only that, the detention center would like to get them out.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have a policy. It seems to be working. I don't know why we need a statute. When you have a policy, you have some flexibility. I have relatives that have trouble with alcohol and have met several police officers in their life. And if you have this law, there's no flexibility when there may be a situation to where a life-changing decision could be made. So I urge some caution on this.
Representative Greer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then I'll be quiet. But one situation where Rose, an individual, it had a couple beers, pulled out. Actually, it had one beer, pulled out, sideswiped a vehicle, stopped. Cops came out, arrested him, took him down to the detention center. It blew somewhere like a .03. I mean, it was a beer. I went down and picked him up. So I guess he'd have to spend the rest of the evening there under this bill now. So I mean, there are circumstances out there that we need to all be aware of when we vote on these things.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, this is already policy, and the juveniles, it's not applying to juveniles. That'd be a different situation. I don't know if the good representative is talking about juveniles. So this is already policy, and in response to that point, policies can be undone, and then we could have the situation again that we had in Natrona County, in the center of our state, the county in our center of our state, and that's the point. Policies are oftentimes reactive. In this case, someone was run over and their life, I mean, they were run over, they were dragged for a great deal of time. Their livelihood has been affected by this. And then the policy came about. It could be undone after a couple years when nothing happens because the policy is in place. This is the legislature saying that in statute, we believe that there's a state interest here to say that this isn't going to be flexible. And we're not going to have these cases happen. So it goes both ways on that point. I mean, a policy can be undone.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for the amendment and for the bill. Members, this really is in response to the case that went on in the center of the state. And prior to this policy even, there was no standard of when a person could be released from a detention center. So we had before that if you had someone that was competent enough to come and get you out of jail, even though that you still might be drunk, you still might be at a .08, that a person could come and get you from the detention center and could take you home or to a safe place. Well, that didn't happen in this case. What happened was is a person was released to someone who they thought was competent, and a tragedy happened after that. So in response to that, a judicial review, they decided amongst all the detention centers across the state, no, our policy is going to be that it's zeros. You have to blow zeros before you get out of jail. And by the way, I know this is going out over the airwaves, but if you're dumb enough to go and drink and drive, then you deserve to spend the night in jail. And you deserve to be there until you blow zeros, until you can go out walking sober. And so that is the practice as it exists right now. The problem with policy, however, is that policy can change. And if we start messing with judicial policy and say, well, we'll release them if they're at a .04. How about that? If they're released to a competent individual. And what we're trying to say by this bill is no. In order for you to get out, we are going to codify this, that it's going to be zeros. If you're going to be that irresponsible and negligent to go out and drink and drive, that you deserve to stay in jail until you can be sober and walk out. And really, that's what this amendment and bill is all about. So I would urge the body to vote aye on the amendment and aye on the bill.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for the amendment. Listen, folks, what you really need to hone in on is the reality that what we're doing is codifying the current practice that's statewide. So the body of the committee and this legislature would not be replacing the will or the thoughts and opinions of the agencies, the detention centers that are already operating. All we're doing is codifying it. But listen, if the biggest objection that can be raised to this body is that, well, what if I want to go pick up my friend or my spouse or whoever it is? Well, that's easy. Bring a second reading amendment and put that into the bill. I don't think anyone's going to object to an amendment that says that if we're releasing an individual in somebody else's care and they take responsibility for the individual, no one's going to object to that. In fact, that's the current law for juveniles. A representative from the center of the state mentioned that this particular law doesn't apply to juveniles, and what he was getting at is the fact that with juveniles we treat them very differently. We allow them to be released in the care of their parents regardless of their BAC. If someone wants to bring an amendment to do that, I don't think there's going to be any objection. So if that's the biggest issue someone can raise with this bill, I think it's easily cured. I think you pass it and you come back on a second or third reading and you cure that defect in the bill. But this is a good law that we as a legislature have the ability to take a firm stance and say that we have that we agree with our detention facilities, our agencies, et cetera, but we also are going to take a firm stance on driving while under the influence after already being arrested for driving under the influence. That's a pretty good policy.
Are you ready for the question? Are you ready for the question? Having heard the motion on the standing committee amendment, question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
Chair, being in doubt, we will have a standing vote. All those in favor, stand up. Aye. All those no, stand up. 35, no. Standing committee, amendment number one has failed. We're back on the bill. Chairman Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now we're back on the bill, and for the explanation, I turn it over to our good colleague from House District 57.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So with the failure of the amendment, what the bill would do is it would, it's a reaction to a situation that we had in the center of our state, as I've said. Someone was arrested for DUI, then was released. Someone picked them up and signed a hold harmless, and they proceeded to go back to the bar and get behind the wheel, and they hit someone and drag them a long way. It's just really an awful situation. So what this bill would do now is it would say that you'd have to blow under .08 to be able to be released after a DUI. Now, we did write this bill so that the policy could remain in place. There's nothing to say that there couldn't be an internal policy to have to blow a zero, and they probably would continue that policy. It certainly sounded like that in the testimony. And so the bill would not change that policy. They could have their own policies, and so it would just codify that in state statute they need to blow under a .08. With that, I stand for questions.
Representative Lindholm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got a little late to the party, so I might have missed this portion in regards to, can you speak in regards to CDL, Class A CDLs, and the requirement of 0.04%, and if that was taken into consideration in the committee, because of the lower level at a Class A CDL, I don't know that that should be addressed. Or, but currently, if you're under 0.02, you can be released if you do blow with a CDL. So I'm curious if that was ever part of the issue that came up. Thank you.
Anyone else? Do I have a call for the question? Representative Olson.
I'll be brief. I just feel like the good representative deserves an answer to his question. And yes, the commercial vehicles and that standard was considered. Ultimately, because the committee amendment brought us down to a zero level, we thought we addressed that. And so there was tossed around the discussion to just amend it to a .04 in order to address the representative's concerns. So I think that if this bill moves on from here, I think that this body still needs to consider that on a second or third reading. You need to consider the representative's concerns, and maybe an amendment to .04 might make more sense. But right now, you're definitely not capturing the commercial issue.
Representative Gray? Anyone else? Representative Nicholas.
Thank you. My question is, what if they never get a blood test? What if they refuse, and if it's not a serious injury, they don't have to give any blood tests. They have an automatic suspension of their license. But what I'm afraid of this bill is going to have more and more people who are going to refuse to blow. And if you refuse to blow at the scene, and if you refuse to allow the testing to either blood, breath, or urine when you're in the station, because you know you're going to be staying in jail all night regardless, why would you do so? I mean, so it might actually have a negative impact on having people cooperate and take the test.
Representative Pinnell.
Mr. Chairman, in answer to that, when they, if they refuse to take a breath, blood, or urine test, that's fine. They can go through that, but there is a process now where they can get that evidence now. You can get a search warrant and get it. But these tests that are done after the fact, they're never used against them in court. Those tests, when they blow in the breath machine, any of those are never taken to court. That's just one of the things that is done. And most generally, these folks want to get out of jail, so they're going to cooperate at that point to do a breath test. And it's usually, like I said, depending on what time they come in, how intoxicated the individual is when they're going to request them to do a test. And it's, if they come in at night, that first thing in the morning, they're going to make sure they take a test to see where they're at. Hopefully I answered your question on that.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, again, the policy is already in place, so this is what's currently happening in response to that question. And also, the bill does lay out on page 3, in the event the arrested person refuses to be tested for release, this is on Romanet 3, the person may be released only after the sheriff or other authority having custody of the arrested person determines the person to be capable of safely operating a motor vehicle.
Any question having been called? All those in favor of Chairman Kirkbride's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 147 do pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 147 has failed the voice vote. In this case, we have to do a standing vote. All those said aye, please stand. Aye. Opposed, please stand. No. Having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Allen. Aye. Baker. No. Barlow. No. Biteman. Aye. Blackburn.
No.
No. Blake.
No.
No. Bovey. No. Brown. No. Burkhart. No. Bird. No. Clausen.
No.
No. Clem.
Aye.
Connolly.
No.
No. Court.
No.
No. Crank.
No.
No. Dayton.
No.
No. Edwards.
Aye.
Eklund.
No.
No. Ayer.
No.
No. Flitner.
No.
No. Freeman.
No.
No. Furphy.
No.
Guru.
No.
No. Gray.
Aye.
Aye. Greer.
No.
No. Haley.
No.
No. Hallinan. Hallinan. Aye. Halverson.
Aye.
Aye. Henderson.
No.
No. Hunt.
No.
No. Jennings.
Aye.
Aye. Kinner.
No.
No. Kirkbride.
Aye.
Aye. Larson Lloyd.
No.
No. Larson Dan.
No.
Lindholm.
No.
Lone.
Aye.
Aye. Laux.
No.
No. McGuire.
No.
No. Madden.
No.
No. McKim. Excused. Miller.
No.
No. Nicholas.
No.
No. Northrup.
No.
No. Obermuller.
No.
No. Olson.
No.
Paxton.
No.
No. Pelkey.
No.
No. Pipirinen.
Aye.
Aye. Ponell.
Aye.
Salazar.
Aye.
Aye. Schwartz.
No.
No. Summers.
No.
No. Steinmetz.
Aye.
Aye. Sweeney. No. Walters?
No.
No. Wilson?
No.
Winters?
No.
No. Zwanitzer?
No.
Mr. Speaker?
No.
No. Closing vote. Are there any changes? Closing vote. Vote is closed. 14 aye, 45 no, 1 excused.
Pursuant to House Rule 10-5B, House Bill 147, having failed a roll call vote, is indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 101. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 101, introduced by Representative Hallinan. School District's Veteran Employee Preference, an act relating to veterans. Mr. Chairman, your committee number 4, Education, to whom was referred House Bill 101, School District's Veterans Employment Preference, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Bovee, Brown, Flitner, Freeman, Hunt, Kenner, Northrup, Paxton, Piperinen. Signed, Representative Northrup, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Northrup?
I move that when a committee of the whole rises in support, to do so with the recommendation that House Bill 101 do pass. And here with the explanation is a good representative from House District 32.
Representative Hallinan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was a question brought up at a school board meeting here in Campbell County that was whether there was a reason or a right to give a veteran's preference. And that is the reason for this bill. The representative of the school board said that the Wyoming School Board Association bylaws and those of the National School Board Association had nothing to say about the issue. He went on to say, I don't see anything, so it really surprised me. I couldn't find one school board that had one policy like that in the state, that is to provide a veteran's preference. What we did not want, the gentleman said, was to find anything discriminating in that issue. He also went on to say, I found that when any class like this is protected by state law, then the federal court stay away from it. Wyoming law or federal law would protect us, he said. That really isn't out there at this time. Unless state legislators act in Wyoming, there isn't much school district officials can do at this point, he said. If there is support at the state level, we could support it. Right now, it's something the school board can't do. That's the impetus for this bill. If you would look on page 2 of the bill, under D, as used in this section, public department shall not include a school district, provided, however, the Board of Trustees of a school district may prescribe rules, regulations, or policies to adopt the preference for appointment or employment granted to veterans and surviving spouses of veterans under this section. Any rules, regulations, or policies adopted by the Board of Trustees of a school district pursuant to this subsection shall not be considered a discriminatory or unfair employment practice under local or state law, equal employment opportunity law, if the granting of the preference is applied uniformly to employment or appointment decisions. Therefore, this addresses that question given by those school board members and the administration of the school district in Campbell County and to the whole entire state, that a veteran's preference is now permitted by this law and would say that it is non-discriminatory. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I propose that we approve this bill for the Committee of the Whole. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question having been called. Chairman Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I do think I need a couple of explanations. What we're trying to do is include one entity that's not now going to be part of a public department. So what evidence that they were ever part of the public department definition is there? And what other entities are under public department, as is in current statute? And obviously you don't have the current statute, but it says, in every public department and upon all public works in Wyoming. So my question is, this is the only one that's going to be exempted, by the way I read this statute. This is the new exemption for the definition of public department. So my first question is, public departments, everything else but school boards? And second has to do with the comment about discriminatory. It would look to me like if we have this exception and then we allow the number of school districts we have to have different policies, then there will be the basis for the potential for discriminatory policies between districts. So that's two questions. One is public department. This is the only exception I see. And two, are we actually creating the potential for discriminatory practices between these individual bodies? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hallinan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I address my colleague from the home of the camels. The question of public department came up when I brought this issue to the attorneys here in the legislature, and they said that a school district does not fit in the category of a public department. I don't know why, but it's considered an independent agency, apparently. So that's the reason why that section is in there. The second part, I don't recall exactly what that question was. So I can't answer that right now. If you had come up, it's discriminatory across districts. I don't think that this, I think this says that according to the state, that it's not discriminatory, and I think that would apply to any district around the state. So I don't really believe that's an issue to be addressed here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else? Representative Steinitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just wondering if this is creating a precedent for school boards to create protected classes in general. Thank you.
Representative Hallinan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my distinguished colleague from down the state, I think, I don't know exactly where she's from, but I'd say that I don't think that this has to do with veterans only. I don't think this applies to anyone else in the state for this kind of preference. That's why I think they needed to have an allowance to have a preference enacted in state law. Otherwise, I don't believe it would be legitimate.
Representative Eklund.
I guess I just need a point of clarification from a previous speaker who asked about how the policy would be shaped. It appears to be independent. And I guess I would really have to question that it isn't already in law. I'm surprised it's brought to us. There seems to be, I cannot imagine that a school isn't a public department or entity.
Representative Hallinan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my distinguished colleague, chairman from around the state. I'd say that the reason this came up is because the school districts did not believe they had a right to give a veteran's preference based on federal law making it discriminatory. Therefore, the reason for this bill was to say that it was not discriminatory and that it was possible to grant a veteran's preference. So that's the simple reason for the bill and the simple effect of it, I think, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else? Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On in support of this bill, and if you look here at the bill on page number 2, in line, I got to look at it here. Line number 3 says, the Board of Trustees of a school district may prescribe rules. This isn't a shall. This is up to district. This is saying that they may prescribe rules. It says regulations or policies to adopt the preference for appointment or employment granted to veterans or surviving spouses of veterans under this section. And so that's something to take into consideration. We're not dictating saying that school districts have to do this. This is just putting it in the statute that they can. And that seems to be the issue that that my colleague here from the land of the camels was talking about, that there was no policy, I guess, in place for them to do that. And so really what we're doing is we're saying that they may do this if they so choose to. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And the reason I'm not arguing with that, the reason that I want clarification on this is if we pass this, it will be a may instead of a what I view as a shall in statute law. The veterans are taken care of in this, and they shall consider them in this other statute. And I think it may weaken what the veterans are trying to get or should get.
Representative Hallinan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that the reason is this issue is the word department. I think the statute covers departments, but it does not cover school districts until this legislation gets passed. Department is considered another entity within state government other than the school districts. That's why the school districts were afraid to grant a veteran's preference. And that's the reason for the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm struggling here just a little bit because as I look in 19 in the definitions, there's no definition for public department. And so when you go to the reference section 1914.102, it says that every public department is required to comply with the Veterans Preference Act. But the bill is exempting public departments from being complying with this. So I think, in my mind, simple as it is, as you all know, is we're doing the opposite. We're actually pulling them out and exempting school districts from complying with that, unless somebody can please show me where the definition for what a public department is and how this. Please, to the Breener.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And indeed, it doesn't define what a public department is. And from what I'm hearing in testimony, and maybe we need to get a better lawyer to help us out or our LSO staff, but the instruction was that the school district is not a public department. And that's what it says there simply there. We're adding on there. If you read it again, line number 1, page 2, as used in this section, a public department shall not include a school district provided. So it does exempt them, or it does say that they're not a part of a public department. But it does say provided, however, the Board of Trustees of a school district may prescribe rules, regulations, or policies to adopt the preference or appointment of employment, et cetera, et cetera. So we're not exempting them from the veteran's preference. Indeed, what we're doing is we're clarifying. If indeed they're not considered a public department, then we're saying so in statute, but we're also saying that if they're not at a public department, still they have to give or they may grant some kind of policy for a veteran's preference. So maybe that's as clear as mud. I don't know. But vote your conscience. I don't know.
Representative Greer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd say right now, this passes forward. What we can look at doing is in subsection A, where it says public department and public works, we could go in and say public department, public works, and school districts, and then we will have a clear statute saying the preference applies, and then also to the questions that were raised earlier, which were very good questions, we'll have an equal application across the districts in the state. But in order to do that, we have to pass it here in first reading and then bring a second reading amendment to do that.
Question? Anyone else? Question haven't been called. All those in favor of Chairman Northrup's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with the recommendation of Bill number 101 do pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 101 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 126. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 126, introduced by Representative Piperinen, Elementary School Foreign Language Requirement, an act relating to education. Mr. Chairman, your committee number 4, Education, to whom was referred House Bill 126, Elementary School Foreign Language Requirement, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Bovee, Brown, Flitner, Freeman, Hunt, Kinner, Northrup, Paxton, Piperinen. Signed, Representative Paxton, Vice Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Northrup?
I move that when a committee of the whole rises to report, that it do so with recommendation that House Bill number 126 do pass. I'm sorry, and here to explain it is a good representative from House District 49.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring to you House Bill 126, Elementary School Foreign Language K-2. This bill would allow school districts the local control to determine how their teaching time in the day will be allotted. House Bill 126 makes a simple change. If you can all look at page 1. At the bottom, line 15, it says the district may. Previously, it was the district shall. Any school district may provide instruction in foreign language to students in kindergarten through grade 2. Making this policy decision to may would allow districts more flexibility in designing their instructional day in light of other pressing curricular activities. This bill further states on page 2 and 3, that a school district that provides instruction in foreign language pursuant to this subsection shall do so in accordance with standards promulgated from the State Board. That is, according to the LSO, that they would continue to adhere to the established benchmarks, standards, and reporting. Now, this doesn't take away the choice of a district to continue this instruction. The districts on the other side of the Wind Rivers may want to continue with their language instruction with their native languages, and that's fine. They can continue to do so. The bill is also about choice for districts. In sharing this bill with district superintendents throughout the state, they overwhelmingly supported it. They know what they need to provide effective instruction in their schools. I stand for questions, and if there are no questions, I would call for the question.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Northrup's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with the recommendation that Bill number 126 do pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 126 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 62. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 62, introduced by Representative Pelkey, Immunity for Drug Overdose Reporting, an act relating to controlled substances. Mr. Chairman, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 62, Immunity for Drug Overdose Reporting, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendment. Ayes, Representatives Byrd, Claussen, Crank, Ayer, Gray, Greer, Henderson, Lindholm, and Laux. Signed, Representative Greer, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Greer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when Committee of the Whole rises, report to do so with a recommendation that House Bill number 62 do pass. I'll further move the Standing Committee Amendment number 1. And what I would like to do is turn it over to the good representative from House District 1 to explain the Standing Committee Amendment.
Representative Pelkey.
No, from House District number 1.
Representative Lindholm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regards to that, we're in the good faith clause, and we're just adding after assistance or immunity so that everyone's very clear on the good faith aspect that if as long as you're operating within good faith, you're not trying to ingest a ton of drugs to be able to hide them, basically. I don't know that I can put that any clearer. I'll stand for questions.
Representative Pelkey, or did you want to speak?
Not on the amendment.
Okay. You have heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Chairman Greer.
Yeah. And then I'll turn explanation of the bill over to the gentleman from House District 45.
Representative Pelkey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Colleagues, this is a bill similar to measures adopted in other states. What we're trying to do is eliminate the fear of prosecution in those situations where an individual may self-report an overdose or may find a friend or colleague in an overdose situation and be reluctant to call law enforcement because of the risk of prosecution for possession. Now, this bill is not it's important to note on line 12, the bill specifically notes it's limited immunity from prosecution. This does not open the door to a drug dealer with, pounds of heroin or other drugs in his possession and allow them immunity from prosecution for the felony of possession with intent to distribute. This is an immunity for possession, misdemeanor possession under the law, and it would simply preclude those persons who are trying to get the assistance of a first responder. Mr. Chairman, you look somewhat alert and confused. Am I doing something?
No, I was just seeing what was going on.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought you were looking for assistance from somewhere. Not to refer to you as confused, I apologize.
That would be accurate, sir.
For all of us, Mr. Chairman. So, I mean, in essence, this is a very limited bill. It has received the support from surprising quarters, and I think largely because it is limited in its scope. It's a bill that that eliminates that initial fear of contacting law enforcement. It helps us prevent overdoses by encouraging folks to go out and get help. It does not open the door for someone to avoid the law, and I appreciate the standing committee amendment in that it adds a little bit more bite to the bill's limitations. This bill is not a free pass to somebody who's driving down the road with a significant amount of drugs who sees a police car in the back of their rear view mirror and decides to go all Cheech and Chong on getting rid of their drugs by consuming them. It's a good faith response to a dire situation is what we're dealing with. You know, and we may make light, and I'm certainly making light of that comedic scenario, but this is a serious problem in Wyoming. We've had hundreds of overdose deaths, particularly overdose deaths from synthetic opioids, otherwise legal synthetic opioids that are consumed illegally in this state since 2010. The numbers are such that there are a number of people who could have been saved by a quick response from a first responder, but those first responders never knew what was happening until it was too late. I would urge the body to consider this bill and vote favorably.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to take a moment to give the body just a minute to look at this bill and understand the history behind this. This is a bill that the concept was studied during the interim on my committee that I sit on, committee number one, and the committee rejected this idea for a number of different reasons. I know it sounds like a great proposal, but when this bill was brought back, it was sent to a different committee that didn't have the knowledge and the testimony that our committee had during the interim. And if you'll look just for a second on page two, there's a number of issues with the real-world application on this. First off, we haven't had any testimony in our committee, and nor have I heard any testimony that this has been an issue. I don't know that there's been a prosecutor yet that's charged someone for reporting one of these incidences. So keeping that in mind, the immunity only comes, if you'll look on page two, line five, if all five of these Roman numerals are met. So I just want to point out, I know we're on general file and this is the first reading of this bill, but it's got a long history.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I feel a little conflicted about this bill. I mean, I think it's got some good intentions. I'm just wondering kind of the practical aspects. So I'm going to kind of lay out a scenario and perhaps some of the members from the committee that heard this bill could answer this, or even from our Judiciary Committee. So let's say, for instance, you have you have two adults and you have two kids in the home, and one, both parents, I guess, and kids, and there's drug use in the home, misdemeanor amounts. One of the parents overdoses. They call and they meet the criteria in the bill. And now there's limited immunity there, so they're not going to get charged with the misdemeanor. Does that preclude them, I guess, from having any other charges brought against them? That's number one. And number two, I suppose, for us younger members anyway, I think, what, there's eight of us that are, eight of you, I guess, in your 20s and several in their 30s. Could you remind us what Cheech and Chong is? Because I'm not exactly sure what that is. Thank you.
Representative Pelkey.
Oh, Lord, I'm showing my age. First of all, this would, in your scenario, I don't think the parents would be immune. The situation is, to those who are reporting, it doesn't It allows immunity for prosecution for possession, but it would not preclude prosecution under other violations. In your, I think in your scenario, you may have posing a risk to minors, and I think that that could still be prosecuted with no problem. I'd like to address an earlier comment. You know, we have had situations around the state where people have been reluctant to report, and frankly, I disagree with my judiciary member or my judiciary colleague. I think there's been ample testimony in front of the committee over the last year and a half, 2 years, that demonstrates a need for this measure.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not an expert in this area at all, but I would like to know, in view of a consequence here, would this bill have a tendency to increase or decrease the propensity to risk an overdose by a user?
Representative Pelkey.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I have not seen any evidence that would suggest that those who are prone to risk an overdose would be more likely to risk an overdose. It certainly does increase the probability that somebody would contact a first responder in the situation of an overdose. But I haven't seen any testimony or data to indicate that it would cause those who are risk-seeking to seek even greater risk.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question about the applicability of this act potentially to underage drinking and whether there could be a benefit there. And the reason I ask is because a few years back in this city, there was a situation where a minor had been drinking and then got an fender bender and basically fled the scene and then froze to death. And so I've been kind of in my own, interim attempts trying to work with some way to respond to that situation. So, I mean, I see that this is just for controlled substances, and I assume that that doesn't, but and maybe that's an expansion for a different session, but if you could just, seems like sort of ran in from committee across the hall, sorry, give me a couple of sentences on the potential applicability to minors in possession.
Representative Pelkey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wilson, I honestly don't think that this bill would address a tragic situation like that you described. One, it involves alcohol. Two, it wouldn't provide immunity for the fender bender, for example. And I can't imagine how this bill would address a tragic situation like that, though I can see similar situations emerging that would be addressed by this bill, and it could potentially save lives.
Majority Floor Leader Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm for the bill, and, this is essentially a Good Samaritan bill. Even if it was a juvenile reporting this, if it's a juvenile and he's going to get arrested or, cause trouble, I don't even know if it applies to a juvenile. Some lawyer is going to have to speak on that. But again, if he's saving his friends or whatever from a bad reaction, we need them to get on the horn and take care of this. Again, that's the purpose of this bill.
Representative Henderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At first, I was skeptical when the testimony was provided in the committee. But as I listened, I'm thinking to myself, I should be on and for this, which I am, because this is an opportunity to save lives. I'm not as experienced as my friend from the springs with rocks in it where the horses run wild, but I'm willing to give this a chance, and And in the interest of saving lives, that's why I think we should be on and for it. Thank you.
Representative Blake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm on this bill. I'm for this bill 100%. A few years ago, a gentleman I work with on the railroad, the big yellow one that runs on the southern bottom of the state, his son got, I don't know what you want to call it, hooked up with the wrong crowd, whatever, but ended up using heroin. Well, it's hard to talk about, too. What happened was the kids he was with did not know what to do, did not want to get in trouble, so they tried to keep the kid awake, pouring water on his face, doing everything they could. Well, what happened was he died. And so if this bill would have been in place, they may have known, and I'm saying what would have happened. I can't say what would have happened. But if they would have known that they would have not gotten in trouble, they could have called that ambulance, could have called the police, got there, and they could have gave him whatever the antidote is for heroin and could have saved his life. So it's real world. It happens. It happened in my community with the gentleman I work with. So please support this bill. Thank you.
Representative Pelkey.
Thank you. Again, this is a bill that protects the reporters. That includes those who have possibly overdosed and are self-reporting, and those who are friends who are providing assistance. That said, this bill is limited in scope. It provides a limited amount of immunity for a very specific set of circumstances, and I would encourage this body to vote in support of this measure.
Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to ask a question of the good sponsor of the bill. I understand right now, and I do remember hearing through the interim, that there was prosecutorial discretion, and so there was an opportunity for them to take a look at all of the things that and then make a judgment call from that particular point. But on page 2, line 3, it moves this to an automatic immunity, apparently. And so it takes away all kinds of discretion, which, from what I understand, thus far in the state hasn't been necessarily a bad thing in this issue. And so I just wanted to hear some commentary on that particular line.
Representative Pelkey.
Thank you. I think, you know, granting prosecutorial discretion after passing this bill is counterproductive. I think that this bill is designed, in essence, to send a message that says, look, we understand there's an emergency. We understand that you or someone near you right then is in trouble, and we want you to know that you can call a first responder and get help immediately and not worry about prosecution. That should not come in as a factor, particularly for those who are simple users. Again, this bill is not something that grants immunity to dealers. It's not something that grants immunity to those who are distributing drugs or in possession of large felony amounts. But it does grant the user, the overdoser, their friends and associates immunity from prosecution. We don't want to leave that into the in the arena of prosecutorial discretion when we're trying to send a message that we care more about young people in this state than we do prosecuting them.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and appreciate the good discussion and the questions and answers. I'm really tilting in favor of this, but I do have another question. So in a scenario where a person does call the police or first responders and they get there, police are involved, and they're not going to charge them for a misdemeanor amount of possession or use or anything like that, can the police, though, still, I guess, help this individual, refer them to treatment or that kind of thing? I don't want to tie the hands of law enforcement to where, you know, it's okay, thanks for calling, have a nice day, that they still can intervene, I guess, in some respects. So if someone could answer that, I'd appreciate it.
Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the good bringer of the bill, I am not opposite your opinions on this. For the most part, I just want to make sure that I'm truly understanding everything. I see on page two, basically, this is immunity from criminal prosecution. So this would move it to a misdemeanor. It sounds like would still be something that could be charged. And then it is regarding on page three, on line 17 and then 20, it's talking about possession of a controlled substance and use of a controlled substance. So I just want to know for sure if, for instance, they did come to the scene and there was a large cache, say, of controlled substances, that would not fall under possession or use of, or let's say that they were an individual that was distributing and so had a large stockpile of something they shouldn't have, would they be completely immune in that circumstance, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Pelkey.
Thank you. The immunity provided is for misdemeanor possession and use. If we're talking large quantities, it's at least felony possession, and quite often it would rise the level of possession with intent to distribute. Again, immunity isn't provided for those. That's one of the reasons that I keep emphasizing the fact that this bill addresses what it considers to be limited immunity. We're dealing with a very limited scope of immunity on a very limited number of possible charges, and it doesn't provide this broad scope of immunity that would keep law enforcement from pursuing other avenues. But in these very limited cases where there are individuals facing risk of death or serious injury from an overdose of a drug, what we want to do is send a message that it's important that these people seek help from first responders first and then go on to perhaps address the situation as Representative Clem suggested through counseling or treatment. And this bill certainly wouldn't preclude anybody from seeking treatment or being recommended for treatment, but they certainly wouldn't fall under the bailiwick of the court in that sense and be ordered into treatment.
Anyone else? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Greer's motion that when a committee of the whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 62 do pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 62 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill,
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
We're going to adjust the general file list slightly. We're going to move House Bill 40 down underneath House Bill 29. So our next bill will be House Bill 15.
Thank you. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 15. House Bill 15. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 15, introduced by Judiciary, Sex Offender Registration Fees and Penalties, an act relating to sex offender registration. Mr. Chairman, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 15, Sex Offender Registration Fees and Penalties, respectfully reports, same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Baker, Biteman, Jennings, Kirkbride, Olson, Pelkey, Ponell, Salazar, and Winters. Signed, Representative Kirkbride, Chairman. This bill was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Burkhart, Larson, Schwartz, Summers, Walters. Noes, Representative Nicholas and Wilson. Signed, Representative Nicholas, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 15 do pass. I turn the explanation over to our good colleague from the land of coal and camels in House District 52.
Representative Pinnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I also urge that you do pass this bill, and I'll explain it. It's an act relating to sex offender registration. And here a few years ago, local departments, sheriff's office, they, of course, received basically an order from this body that they needed to register all sex offenders in their jurisdiction. At that time, there was no funds given to the folks to implement this, but they did. They went on ahead and implemented it, and they also then during the course of this, they worked with the state and folks in the criminal division of it to work with them to come up with a program that would assist them in the notification process. Well, of course, during that time frame, the cost, there was a program out there that really didn't fit well, and so basically the sheriffs from around the state requested that they look at another program, which did have a cost to it. As we all know, anytime you implement a computer program, there's costs and fees, and usually they're ongoing. They're not just one-time fee. So what they did is they the system that is currently in place now is roughly a cost of $130,000. And currently, this system is still funded, and I believe it's funded through 2019, I believe it is. I could be wrong, but I believe it is, yeah, after 2019. Then they're going to be looking at other avenues for funding. And this is just a bill that kind of goes forward, and it's not a reaction to the when they finally figure out they run out of money. This is a bill that kind of looks at it forward, and it starts the process of collecting funds to help pay for that system. The system in place is a good system, and again, it's a split. Now, the local authorities will get a share of this revenue, a small portion, but the folks back down here in this area that we're visiting will get the biggest share. Because, of course, they have a big cost, and implementing this will assist. Now, there's different levels of this registration form that they will go through where folks will go in to be registered. Some of them have to go in just one time a year. Some go in quarterly. Some go in a couple times a year. So initially, cost that they're looking at would be I'll have to refer to my notes here, but the initial registration fee is $100, and then, of course, each time after that would be $75. In this bill, it also explains that if the individuals are in jail or obviously indigent, they're not going to have to pay for this. I mean, we're not going to force somebody to pay a fee that doesn't have any money. I mean, we know the process on that. So I would urge your vote in favor of this bill, and then I will stand for any questions.
Representative Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I have several questions. Let's just talk about the division of the money. X amount of dollars for the agency that resides in the capital city, and a proportion, 25% of that fee for the community where the actual person is registered. So what was the testimony about what the cost is in the community? Because we hear about costs being pushed down on our local communities because the state wants to do less. So my question is, does the amount of money being sent to the local government, to the local offices, does it actually address the cost that they will incur in collecting these dollars, et cetera, et cetera? The second thing I guess I would just point out is in a little more philosophical is maybe a fine after the fact. The state has established this system, and obviously the government to the larger government structure has established this, but these folks have paid their due to society, paid their fines, gone to prison, et cetera, et cetera, and now we're imposing another penalty, if you will, and a civil matter. This is not a criminal matter, but a civil matter. So my question is, where's the due process for these folks? Unless they're poor or in jail, they get no choice for something that's long in history. So a couple questions. Are actually covering the cost that's going to be incurred locally? And what is the money going to be used for at the state level? And two, I'm a little concerned about this applying a penalty, if you will, long after someone may have served all of their required time based on their adjudication. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Swanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had basically the exact same questions as the previous speaker, but he put them more eloquently than I can. So everything the good Chairman of Labor said, just double that.
Representative Winters.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me start with the first question as to regarding the cost split. That fee is split between the local folks that investigate criminals, and then the local sheriff's department. And that's because the state maintains the software and the program. And what happened is back in 2007, we started off with our own software program. And it was not cost effective. The testimony that we received in committee was that it was like trying to build from scratch your own SUV as opposed to driving down to a dealership and take what they have put together and building it from there and buying it off the market. And so what happens is the maintenance of that software program is the vast majority of the cost, which is the reason why the state bears or receives most of the fee structure here is because they're the ones bearing most of the cost. And yes, it does also go down to the sheriff's department just for whatever software and computer systems may be necessary at that particular level. But that's the reason why the local DCI receives most of this right here.
Representative Pinnell.
Mr. Chairman, and also to add on to that, the association that involves all the sheriffs around the state, they were in complete agreement with this. They felt that the amount that was going to the state was adequate, and of course, as far as cost goes, yeah, they've got a cost back home, but they're more than happy to give that share to the state due to the simple fact that this software program is an excellent program, and they are the ones that recommended it. To the second question, as far as if they've served their time, done their time, paid their penalty, and so forth, these registrations, they're court ordered to register. This comes into play to where they are required by state law, and usually across the country. And also, many of these individuals that there's in Wyoming, we have a total of 1,548 sex offenders in the state. About 35% of those individuals come from out of state, come to this great state. So this cost, I don't know if I can answer that question completely, but the court has ordered them to register once they come into this state. So that, you know, they're paying a fee to help basically keep that program up and running as far as so we can keep accurate information. And some of those individuals, you want to know where they're at. You don't want to know where they're living. You want to know where they're working. Thank you.
Representative Swanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to back it up again, I just can't get past the fact that it's just mean, I guess, is for lack of a better term. And I'm sure the counties are perfectly fine with putting the fees on the backs of sex offenders, and nobody in this body wants to defend sex offenders. I understand, but you're basically moving general fund dollars to private parties who have, I mean, I guess you never really, in one of these crimes, finish serving your time because you are required to register and check in for the rest of your life. But it does seem to be a civil penalty now after the fact that people who register now and have done their due diligence and go in every quarter or every 6 months or every year and are trying their hardest to comply, you're now going to say not only that, but we're going to charge you a fee for the government to run the program, And maybe it'd be one thing, I mean, if these were people who made six-figure salaries, but these are already people who were, I mean, A, we're tracking, which is good, but B, are, it's very difficult for them to find employment, which is understandable. But I guess my fear, and maybe the question I'd pose, is if you start mandating these people to pay $80, those people who do have to come in every quarter, are we worried at all about them saying, hey, this is just too much, I'm skipping out, I'm not going to do it? I'm sure in the grand scheme of life we'd like for them to maybe leave the state altogether, which I understand. But my concern would be, let's say they just don't have that extra $80 a quarter and they say, hey, I don't have it, I'm not going to go to my appointment, I'm not going to check in. Well, then the sheriff has to go out and get them, and the cost of trying them for a misdemeanor for failing to do this is going to be a greater cost, which that cost still comes back on the state, than if we didn't have this law at all to begin with. So that's my concern, is do we have any fear that people are going to look at this and say, hey, I don't have that kind of money, this is a new burden imposed on me, and they're just going to skip out on meeting these appointments, and then we're going to have to send law enforcement out after them, and it's actually going to cost us more, and probably cost the state more, not the counties. I totally understand why the counties want us to do this. But we're just, are we shooting ourselves in the foot for something that sounds good but is actually going to backfire on us in the long run?
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to step back for a minute and take just a second to fill the body in on the history of this bill as well, so that we don't get confused and so that we understand the genesis and origin of this. Now, when these individuals are required to register, they're required to register by federal statute that's passed down to the states. So regardless of what we decide on this bill, these individuals are going to have to register. The state's going to have to maintain a system. There's going to be cost to the state. Now back up. As the previous speaker spoke, or a previous speaker had spoken about, we had a system that was designed that was for our state, and the state decided to go ahead and adopt another system that was able to utilize and interact with other systems throughout the nation. So it's something that was a little bit easier to work with in their eyes. But the origin of this bill really is that when we decided we were going to adopt that new system, we had a grant for this system that was for the biennium. So now the money's gone, exactly as one person said. So regardless of what we decide on this bill, whether we decide to put the burden on the state or the burden on those individuals that have been convicted of a crime and adjudicated through our process. So it's either going to be a user fee, or it's going to be, basically in my eyes, a tax on the rest of the citizens of this state. So that to me breaks it down.
Representative Pinnell.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. In answer to we've already answered the one question there, we're not going to force people to make this payment when they don't have money. So it's not going to be a cost that we're going to go after them in court trying to get those funds when they're indigent. So we've already looked at it, and it's in this bill that we're not going to go after folks that are indigent. So with that.
Chairman Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's been a little question for clarification on how often you report and does it go on forever and so forth. Good question. So let me direct you to page 3 of the bill addresses that. The initial registration fee would be $100 total. The county would collect all 100 and then remit 80 to the state. Subsequent registrations would be 75 total. The county would hang on to $15 and remit 60 to the state. Now, how long does it go on for? And how often do you pay? Well, it depends what level of a sex offender you are. If you're the highest level, you'd register and be subject to these fees 4 times a year and pay it the rest of your life, unless you're juvenile, and then it's 10 years. If you're what I'd call a medium level, an H-level offender, it's a 25-year commitment to that. You'd only pay the fees twice a year. And if you're a G-level, it's a 10-year commitment, and you're paying them once a year. So it's a big bite. We won't deny that, but we also think the contingency fund there for people that they know are not going to be able to afford it is one of the things that takes some of the bite out of it, and you can see how you feel about that.
Representative Olson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to address a few things, and I want to key in on the indigency status that exists. So I think it's 140 or 150% of the poverty level. So while, yes, the fee is assessed annually or quarterly, depending on how you decide to register, the reality is that if an individual cannot afford this, i.e. we're taking away their grocery money, they will qualify through an application to have the fee waived. Now, something else even more importantly that I want you to consider is that Wyoming is not the first and only state to consider this concept. In fact, in some areas in California, folks pay as much as $600 a year in registration fees. And what we see across the nation as states begin to enact registration requirements, states around those states who do not have the fees become what? A safe haven. States around Wyoming have enacted fees. If we do nothing, we continue to be a safe haven. So what does that mean? It means individuals will forum shop, and they do. And they already, well, I don't want to say forum, not necessarily a forum, but they will shop for areas most convenient to them. And they already do this in California. In fact, California is having this discrepancy across counties because the fees may be 300 in one county and 600 in another. So folks begin to move around in order to get the best bang for their buck. And so I think you have a policy decision as well in Wyoming, whether you want to create an atmosphere that encourages it while other states assess fines and fees. Now, that's separate and apart from, of course, paying for the cost just to administer the program itself. But I think that's something to consider. And then lastly, you know, in Laramie County, we actually have a civil employee whose job is nothing but to follow through with these registrations. And it's a full-time job, checking the registrations, processing the applications, building a relationship with the offenders so that the offenders will return and continue to register. And that costs a lot of money. And so in your bigger counties, you know, think about that as well. And I can't speak to Natrona County, but just some things to chew on there.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder, during the interim or even during the committee work this session, if there was any talk about if something like this would actually discourage offenders. In other words, maybe they're not indigent and maybe they can pay, but maybe they're right on the line there and they were normally registered, but, man, the funds are tight and now, oh crap, you know, now I miss registering, and now I can get in trouble, and, oh, man, I'm going to get in deep trouble, and, oh, what the heck with it, I'm just going to go reoffend. I mean, was there any talk about how this might be actually a discouragement to a person who is complying with the registration and doing things thus far? Can anybody speak to that?
Representative Pinnell.
Mr. Chairman, there was some discussion on this, actually. And you're going to have those offenders that are not going to register. They're already out there. As far as discouraging the folks to do it because there's a price, you know, there's no data out there that says that don't either, you know, that they won't. But the folks that don't want to won't, and the folks that have been doing it will continue to do so, from what we understand. So you know, I would urge your support on this bill. Thank you.
Representative Swanitzer.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. So listening to the last couple of speakers, I have some more concerns, because it does seem also wrong to me that the agency who gets the money gets to decide whether or not these people are indigent. I mean, not that anything nefarious would go on, but you're basically applying to the agency that would be paying the money and asking them to make a determination if you truly are indigent. And I don't think we have any provisions in statute. Maybe in rules and regs they could clarify if it's a level of poverty or, you know, if they're above the poverty line or what their income is. But it does seem pretty weird to me that you would tell the agency and they get to decide whether or not the person's indigent. And not that I should defend sex offenders, but in our previous business we had sex offenders work for us, and I know I'd like to say they're all horrible people, but some of them truly, you know, repent and pay their time and have moved on with their lives or have tried to move on with their lives except for this registration requirement. And we keep, and it hasn't been as bad the last couple of years, but I certainly remember in this body where it was basically a race to the bottom, that if every state could make their laws a little bit tougher and a little bit tougher and a little bit tougher, you'd get the sex offenders to move out of the state. And I certainly don't think we should try to, you know, be open for the business to have other jurisdictions force them into our state. But it, there is a point where you say, well, where does it stop? I mean, we should have parity with other states. Maybe we should have fees similar so we don't have forum shopping or whatever we referred to it. But there's got to be a line where you kind of say, you know, we're trying to help the community. We're trying to help people rehabilitate. And we're asking, this is a government service. I mean, it's a community service that the government provides to all members of Wyoming, that we track these individuals, that we have them on a website. And it's a public service to our state. And I would argue that if it is, in fact, a public service to our state, then we should take money from general fund dollars, from the taxpayers' dollars, to provide them this service, that it just seems wrong to me to put it on the backs of the people who've served their time. And I know we talked maybe there's an amendment that anybody going forward we can do this to, but there might be people, you know, they've been 5 or 10 years clean, no problems. They're checking in once a year, once every 6 months. And it just seems really wrong to me to put a burden on them now after the length of their sentence is over, besides the reporting requirements. So if those concerns could also be addressed.
Anyone else? Do I hear a call for the question? Chairman Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one other aspect to this. We've discussed kind of the moral aspects of it, and it's been good discussion and many strong points were made. There's also the financial aspects of this. In a state where we're singing the blues most every day about something, this agency is trying to come up with a plan to cover the cost of an important program on into the future. And we either, if we can't cover the cost, we lose the program, or we have to come up with about $250,000 every year to fund it some other way. So the agency was looking for a way to avoid coming to our favorite committee with an exception request, you know, on in the years to come and putting the pressure on the state in a different way. So keep that question in mind, too, as you're thinking through how you're going to vote.
Representative Lindholm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So a question that just came up. A good thought by some constituents that I've got that are visiting. Is this going to be a cost of living allowance? Are we going to have to revisit this, or is there a built-in allowance that automatically jets up? I guess I didn't see that in the legislation. So are we revisiting every couple of years on this if prices go up?
Representative Pinnell.
Mr. Chairman, currently, the way the statute reads, there's not a cost of living built into it. What you see is the fee on here is the fee that will go on unless down the road somebody brings a bill to amend that.
No further discussion. Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Kirkbride's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with recommendation that Bill number 15 do pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Chairman being uncertain, we will have a standing vote. All those who said aye, please stand. Ayes. Those who voted no, please stand. Twenty-seven noes. House Bill 15 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Our next bill for consideration is House Bill 112.
House Bill 112, introduced by Labor, Health, and Social Services. EMS Licensure Interstate Compact, an act relating to emergency medical services licensure. Mr. Chairman, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred House Bill 112, EMS Licensure Interstate Compact, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Barlow, Clem, Dayton, Giroux, Hallinan, Halverson, McGuire, Sweeney. Noes, Representative Lone. Signed, Representative Barlow, Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to committee number 2, Appropriations, which returned a committee recommendation of due pass. Ayes, Representatives Burkhart, Larson, Nicholas, Schwartz, Summers, Walters, Wilson. Signed, Representative Nicholas, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report. It does so with the recommendation that House Bill 112 do pass, and I turn the explanation bill over to the House Doctor.
Representative Hennenen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a very long bill, and I'll just go through it, walk through it page by page. We have a copy of the put up by Wyoming Hospitalization or Hospital Association for you to look at for discussion of the bill and some of its details as well. The heading of the bill is an act relating to emergency medical service licensure, adopting the recognition of emergency medical services personnel licensure interstate compact. And I'll refer to that hereinafter as the compact. Allowing EMS personnel in one compact state to exercise practice privileges in other states, other member states, approving and specifying terms of the compact, making conforming amendments, and providing for an effective date. Page 2 talks about the compact, and it's known as the replica. And we have a copy of that that we submitted to the State Attorney General, and he said that he found that the compact was legitimate and could be enacted. In order to protect, the purpose of the compact is to protect the public through verification of competency and ensure accountability for patient care-related activities. All state-licensed emergency personnel, such as EMTs, advanced EMTs, and paramedics, this compact is intended to facilitate the day-to-day movement of EMS personnel across state boundaries and the performance of their duties. It's also to afford immediate legal recognition to EMS personnel licensed in a member state. That such regulation shared among the member states will best protect public health and safety. Then on page 3, we've got some, or page 4, and page 3, we've got some definitions. Page 4, page 5, I'll skip a page. In page 5, it says adverse action. That means any administrative, civil, equitable, or criminal action permitted by a state's law which may be imposed against licensed EMS personnel by a state EMS authority. Certification means the successful verification of entry-level cognitive and psychomotor competency. Commission refers to the national administrative body of all states that have enacted the compact as members. Emergency medical technicians, means an individual licensed with cognitive knowledge and a scope of practice that corresponds to that level in the National EMS Educational Standards and National EMS Scope of Practice model. License means the authorization by a state for an individual to practice as an EMT, AEMT, paramedic, or a level in between EMT and paramedic. Medical director means a physician licensed in a member state who is accountable for the care provided by EMS personnel. On page 7, rules are defined as a written statement by the Interstate Commission promulgated pursuant to Section 12 of this compact that is of general applicability, implements, interprets, or prescribes a policy or provision of the compact. That shows you how powerful the compact is. Page 8, scope of practice means defined parameters of various duties or services that may be provided by an individual with specific credentials. Page 9, a home state's license authorizes an individual to practice in a remote state under the privilege to practice only if the home state currently requires the use of National Registry of EMTs examination as a condition of licensing initial licensees at the EMT and paramedic level. So that shows that national licensure is required by the people that participate in this program. It notifies the commission in compliance with the terms herein of any adverse action or significant investigatory information regarding an individual. Page 11, to exercise the privilege to practice under the terms and provisions of this compact, the individual must be at least 18 years of age, possess a current unrestricted license in a member state, practice under the supervision of a medical director, an individual providing care in a remote state under the privilege to practice shall function within the scope of practice authorized by the home state, unless and until modified by an appropriate authority in the remote state, as may be defined in the rules of the commission. Except as provided in Section 4, subsection C, an individual practicing in a remote state will be subject to the remote state's authority and laws. If an individual's license in any home state is restricted or suspended, the individual shall not be eligible to practice in a remote state under the privilege to practice until the individual's home state license is restored. Then on page 13, there is some discussion of the conditions of practice in a remote state. The individual originates a patient transport in a home state and transports the patient to a remote state. Another item is the individual originates in the home state and enters a remote state to pick up a patient and provide care and transport to the patient to the home state. Page 14 and 15, there is a discussion of member states that they shall consider a veteran, active military service member, and a member of the National Guard and Reserves who holds a current valid and unrestricted NREMT certification. And those people would be, they would be trying to get those people approved for this organization. Page 16, if an individual's license in any home state is restricted or suspended, the individual shall not be eligible to practice in a home state under the privilege to practice until the individual's home state license is restored. Page 17 is more issues about the adverse action. Page 18 shows that the state's EMS authority, in addition to any other powers granted under state law, is authorized under this compact to issue subpoenas for both hearings and investigations that require the attendance and testimony of witnesses and the production of evidence. So you see, they have a lot of legal power. On page 19, the organization can issue cease and desist orders to restrict, suspend, or revoke any individual's privilege to practice in the state. Page 20, each member shall have and be limited to one delegate to the commission. The commission issues are covered in page 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, and they all are very detailed, and they afford pretty much rights of that we have in our body here to this organization. This is also on page 28 and 29. It says on the bottom of 29 that the organization can perform any other functions as may be necessary or appropriate to achieve the purpose of this compact, consistent with the state regulation of EMS personnel licensure and practice. Also on that page above it, it says that the commission can establish a budget and make expenditures and is able to borrow money. Page 31, on commission issues, the commission shall not incur obligations of any kind prior to securing the funds adequate to meet the same. So that does kind of go against the issue where they can borrow money. Nor shall the commission pledge the credit of any of the member states except by and with the authority of the member state. So that frees our state from being pledged in any debts. Qualified immunity and indemnification. The members, officers, executive directors shall be immune from suit and liability. That's all has to do with commissions. Then on page 33, we go into a coordinated database that the commission can provide for the development and maintenance of a coordinated database and reporting system containing licensure, adverse action, and significant investigatory information on all licensed individuals in member states, so they can keep good track of all their members in the member states. Notwithstanding any other provision of state law to the contrary, a member state shall submit a uniform data set to the coordinated database based on all individuals to whom this compact is applicable as required by the rules of the commission. And they list the items that they require in that database. On page 35 under C, the coordinated database administrator shall promptly notify all member states of any adverse action taken against or significant investigative information on any individual in a member state. So they do report that around the organization. On page 36, rulemaking. The commission shall exercise its rulemaking powers pursuant to the criteria set forth in this section and the rules adopted thereunder. And it lists that the various rules of the organization and how they're arrived at. The notice of proposed rulemaking shall include, and this is something that they require in order for rules to be passed, that proposed time, date, and location of the meeting to which the rule will be considered and voted upon. And then they go into the minority rights of the members of the organization. Hearings shall be conducted in a manner providing each person who wishes to comment a fair and reasonable opportunity to comment orally or in writing. And on page 40, the commission shall, by a majority vote of all members, take final action on the proposed rule and shall determine the effective date of the rule, if any, based on the rulemaking record and full text of the rule. In other words, they operate kind of like our legislature. Emergency rulemaking, that is covered on page 41. And they give the commission the authority to adopt rules and amendments for purpose of correcting typographical errors and format errors and consistency or grammatical errors. Enforcement is on page 42. The provisions of this compact on page line 18. The provisions of this compact and the rules promulgated hereunder shall have standing as statutory law. So that shows how important this compact is. On page 43, it discusses default by a member state and in the performance of its obligations or responsibilities under the compact. And the commission shall provide written notice to the defaulting state or other member states of the nature of the default. On page 44, termination of membership in the compact shall be imposed only after all other means of securing compliance have been exhausted. Notice of intent to suspend or terminate shall be given by the commission to the governor, the majority and minority leaders of the defaulting state's legislature, and each of the member states. A state that has been terminated is responsible for all assessments, obligations, and liabilities incurred during the effective date of termination, including obligations that extend beyond the effective date of termination. Upon receipt, on page 45, upon receipt by a member state, the commission shall attempt to resolve disputes related to the compact that arise among member states and between member and non-member states. Page 46 talks about the enforcement of the reasonable exercise of its discretion shall enforce the provisions and rules of this compact. The date of implementation of the Interstate Commerce Commission for EMS personnel, practice, and associated rules and withdrawal and amendment. The compact shall come into effect on the date of which the compact statute is enacted into law in the 10th member state. Currently, I think there are 7 members, so it's not really in effect yet as a compact. Any member state may withdraw from this compact by enacting a statute repealing the same. A member state's withdrawal shall not take effect until 6 months after enactment of the repealing statute. This compact may be amended by the member states. No amendment to this compact shall become effective and be binding upon any member state until it is enacted into laws of all member states. So that does provide some protection for us. Then on Section 2, it's simply relating the issues of the compact back into our statutes. 33.1.116 is covered on page 14 and 15 of this compact. definitions, divisions is included of divisions, is which division shall be the state EMS authority for purposes of the recognition of emergency medical services personnel licensure interstate compact. That would be the Department of Health. That's written into law in that statute. Emergency medical technician means a person who has graduated from a division-approved training program for emergency medical technicians for the purposes of the Act. Rules and regulations. Any rules necessary for implementation of the compact, the division shall recognize the practice requirements of the Act. Item F on page 51, the division shall administer the provisions of the recognition of the Act, including factoring the annual assessment required under the compact into its biennial budget. We'll be seeing that discussed in our standing committee amendment on this bill. Page 52, section G, is again a discussion of how the veterans and the spouses meet the requirements of the Emergency Medical Services Personnel Interstate Compact Act and how they are fitted into that organization. 52, 33, 36, 110 on page 52, to the extent the right to practice in Wyoming is not already provided by the Act and if necessary to manage an emergency in this state, the division may issue temporary emergency medical technician licenses to emergency medical technicians who are retired, who have an inactive license, or who are licensed in another state without a valid Wyoming license. Page 53, the division shall recognize the right of emergency medical technician personnel licensed in another state to practice in Wyoming to the extent required by the recognition of the Act. Authorized Act of Emergency Medical Technicians. They may provide emergency medical technician services in other states as provided by the Act. And that's on 3336.111. 3336.112 shows that the commission can, if a person is engaging in any practices which constitute a violation of 3336.103, the division may make application to take appropriate court action for an order enjoining those acts. And upon a showing by the division that the person has engaged or is about to engage in any illegal act, an injunction, restraining order, or other appropriate order may be granted by the court without bond. On page 54, we have the old statute wherein any person who violates any provisions of these new items, including the items pertaining to the Act, is guilty of a misdemeanor and upon conviction shall be fined not more than $400 or imprisoned in the county jail not more than 6 months or both. So this is one of the things that the commission can do to somebody who violates the provisions of the Act. The division the final sentence on page 55, the division shall comply with the recognition of the Act when taking any action under this section. So that being the description of the bill in some detail, maybe more detail than you wanted, but that's how long the bill is, and it had to be discussed. So with that, I move that the organization approve this bill, and with the approval of the EMS personnel around our state who want this done, I would say that we should support their efforts. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have a committee of the whole amendment. Discussion first. Representative Lone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First off, I'd like to say that that was a great job explaining an extremely long bill. I'm personally speaking out against this bill. I would like to first take you to page 19. The first 18 pages are great. They are wonderful pieces of information in support of our EMS. There are some concerns I have, though, starting on page 19. Line number 17, we're creating a joint public agency. Further on, if you understand that we've now created an agency that has capabilities, if you switch to page 27, we're giving this new agency the ability, on line 7, to promulgate uniform rules which have the force and effect of law, taking that ability out of our hands. They can bring, on line 12, prosecute legal proceedings and actions in the name of that commission. Furthermore, they can start borrowing money, accepting contracts, providing services for personnel. On page 28, they can hire employees. All of these things are items we have not discussed a cost on, as this is passed through, that we would be forced into paying for. Furthermore, on page 29, line number 1, part 8, they can sell and convey mortgages. Line 5, they can establish a budget. With the ability to establish a budget, you can then follow on to page 30, where they can appropriate a revenue source. And line 12, they may levy and collect an annual assessment from us as a state. They can also impose fees on parties like the EMS members. They can start charging for licenses, which our state currently does not charge for. Frankly, I believe there's some concerns with this that have not been hashed out. And this being model legislation, we cannot alter the first 49 pages of this bill. I strongly recommend we not pass this at this time. I urge you to vote no on this piece of legislation. Thank you.
Chairman Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So let's get back to what we're doing here. What we're trying to do is establish a framework where emergency medical services can be provided across state line with some level of continuity. So if somebody is transported from this state to a state to the south, east, or west, and those people and that state is part of the compact, then our folks will be covered. So we have a structure. And when those folks from another state come into our state and we're both in the compact, we have some ability to deal with that as well. There's certainly legitimate concerns about compacts and about the intent of compacts and all that. But I want to point out, in the last 3 years, we've adopted 3 others, one for physicians, one for nurses, and one for advanced practice nurses. And if we're in a state that is lacking in health care and access to health care, this is a tool to actually bring more EMS into this state by allowing out-of-state folks to practice here and giving our folks protection when they travel to another state. Because otherwise, all of those states, you would have to have an individual license for each state. And in the context of this bill and where this compact is set up, you have a single license and you would be able to practice in all of the compact states. Not a perfect solution, but folks, the purpose here is to give coverage to our EMS personnel and to provide better access and better service to the citizens of this state and to our neighboring, potentially compact states. And if you look in your box, there's an outline of those other states, and 3 of those states that have already adopted this are neighboring states to this state. And all of them are in some of the most remote country that we have, where we do need access and we do want qualified people coming in and taking care of our citizens and us reciprocating to them. So I would urge your support of the bill. Concerns within the compact and the context of the compact, we get representation on the compact commission. We will have the ability to, our state does. And secondly, we can step out of this with 6 months' notice. though it's not like this is forever. If something goes haywire within the context of the compact and the commission which oversees it, the state of Wyoming still can exercise its ability to exit the compact without any recourse. So I'd urge your support of the bill, and there is a standing committee amendment to deal with some of the dollar amount fees, dollar amount stuff, but I will yield for more discussion on the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, the compacts that we already passed for the three professions just mentioned by the good chairman of Labor Health are fine, and they apply to paid professionals. It's not the paid professionals I'm worried about. It's the volunteers in our rural services that concern me. I've only been in on two of these meetings, but I did gather up some paperwork from the interim meetings, and there were some concerns raised that it could be the final nail in the coffin for some of the little services that cannot afford to pay for full-time staff. Is the gain worth the risk? And the question, why did we leave the National Registry of Emergency Technicians in 2007? This is not perfect for rural volunteer services, and I wonder if they're going to put my neighborhood, my small, remote valley, surrounded by mountains and a big lake, if it's going to minimize the applicants that we rely on for volunteer service that can't afford, that can't take off from their day job to drive 5 hours to a testing site. That are volunteering out of the goodness of their heart, and now they're asked to come up with registration fees, licensure fees, testing fees. I have no evidence that this will hurt them, but these are the concerns that I need addressed before I can support this bill.
Representative Grew.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We heard a lot of testimony in our committee on this bill, and I can tell you that it enjoys the support of that association where many of us go for health care. And the one of the more compelling things for me was that of the seven states that have approved this are the states immediately to our south, to our west, and that beehive state that's kind of around the corner. And so these are all states that are near us, and with so many of our citizens living near borders, and especially in my neck of the woods, this is a bill that our local EMTs are for, and I urge you to support the bill.
Representative Hallinan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would want you all to note that the purpose of this organization on page 3 is to protect the public's health and safety, and especially patient safety. By the approval of the licensing methodology, we are guaranteeing a quality of care that can't otherwise be guaranteed. And this compact provides the overriding organization for this entire issue to be discussed. So I think that we need to give this organization the opportunity to demonstrate its capability in providing for patients' health and safety, and especially patient safety. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gray.
Mr. Chairman, could we have some discussion about the fees in this commission? I mean, it says in the fiscal note that they're assuming the fees are similar to the nursing compact, And it's pretty clear here that we're authorizing payment of these fees, but it seems like we don't have an idea of what the fees are going to be. So I'd like some discussion on that. Thank you.
Representative McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to speak to the standing amendment. It was brought by myself and my colleague from House District Number 32. I would like to move the committee of the amendment whole number one.
Please explain your amendment, Representative McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As my dad would say, what's the point of having a bureaucracy if you don't use it? And obviously, we're trying to join a big, huge bureaucracy, so this is great. The two issues that came up during the discussion were, A, that the controlling agency has no ability right now to collect any fees. So we wanted to fix that. And secondly, the second one was, once we do join the compact, the projected cost to the general fund is $8,500, and we asked our esteemed legal advisors to go in and make it revenue neutral. So there was the standing committee amendment was handed out right after lunch. It should be in your boxes. It's one page long. The important language is that it goes back into 3336110H. On page 49, line number 19, and adds the ability for the agency to collect fees. And then really the important language is at the bottom, and that would be paragraph K, where it says the division shall establish in rule and regulation fees for issuing initial and renewal licenses under the section. Fees established pursuant to the section shall be in the amount to ensure that the extent practical the total revenue generated from the fees collected approximate but does not exceed the direct and indirect costs of administering this section and the provisions of the recognition of emergency medical services personnel, licensure, interstate, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, what we're looking to do is make it revenue neutral, and those who are affected by this, certainly they will have a voice and they will have a very clear concern to keep the expenditures on the lower end, but there is a true concern to the state, and that is that all of these bureaucracies have a tendency to grow. My sister is a member of one of the other interstate compacts, and they just got another call because they had to buy a brand new computer, and there was only one computer that will contact or talk to the interstate compact, blah, 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 so they had to buy that computer. So there's always going to be additional expenses, and what the goal of this particular amendment was again to make it revenue neutral and to let the agency and the individuals who would be members of the Interstate Compact to regulate themselves and to regulate their own expenses. So I would stand for questions.
All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The amendment passes. Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Barlow's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Bill Number 112 do pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
House Bill 112 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Majority Floor Leader Miller.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor say aye. Opposed, say no. The motion carries.
Right here.
The reading clerk will read the committee of the whole report.
January 23rd, 2017. Mr. Speaker, our committee of the whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. House Bill 23, recommended do pass. House Bill 66, following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. House Bill 37, recommended do pass. House Bill 77, recommended do pass. House Bill 93, amended as follows, recommended do pass. House Bill 119, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 87, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 147, following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. House Bill 101, recommended do pass. House Bill 126, recommended do pass. House Bill 62, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 15, recommended do pass. House Bill 112, amended, recommended do pass. Signed, Representative Obermueller, Chairman.
I move the adoption of the committee of the whole report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. Congratulations, Representative Obermueller.
Well done.
Well done. That was a long day in the chair. I didn't know you were such a sweet tooth. Wow. Okay, we're at that order of business. Reports from standing committees.
House Bill 114, introduced by Representative Brown, Service and Assistant Animals, an act relating to service and assistant animals. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Bill 114, Service and Assistance Animals, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Blackburn, Byrd, Edwards, Ayer, Furphy, Lindholm, Lone, Sweeney, Zwanitzer. Signed, Representative Zwanitzer, Chairman. House Bill 152, introduced by Representative Lindholm, Search and Rescue Operations, an act relating to search and rescue operations. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Bill 152, Search and Rescue Operations, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Blackburn, Byrd, Edwards, Ayer, Furphy, Lindholm, Lone, Sweeney, Zwanitzer. Signed, Representative Zwanitzer, Chairman. House Bill 161, introduced by Representative Pelkey, Divorce Residency, an act relating to domestic relations. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Bill 161, Divorce Residency, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Blackburn, Byrd, Edwards, Ayer, Furphy, Lindholm, Lone, Sweeney, Zwanitzer. Signed, Representative Zwanitzer, Chairman. House Bill 98, introduced by Representative Greer, LLC Dissolution Distributions, an act relating to limited liability companies. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 98, LLC Dissolution Distributions, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Byrd, Claussen, Crank, Ayer, Gray, Greer, Henderson, Lindholm, and Laux. Signed, Representative Laux, Vice Chairman. House Bill 153, introduced by Representative Jennings, Parental Rights, an act relating to parents. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 153, Parental Rights, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Byrd, Claussen, Crank, Ayer, Gray, Greer, Henderson, Lindholm, and Laux. Signed, Representative Greer.
Messages from the Senate.
Mr. Speaker, message number 142, January 23rd, 2017. The bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 4, Water Projects, Map and Plat Filing Requirements. Ayes, 30. Signed, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 143. Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 19, Snowplow Lights. Ayes, 30. Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 144. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed the Senate on third reading in amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 21, Death Certificates. Ayes, 30. Signed, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 145. Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 38, Veteran License Plate Stickers, Repeal. Ayes, 30. Signed, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 146. Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 64, Accident Report Confidentiality. Ayes, 30. Signed, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 147. Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File number 92, Local Governments Plan Review Authority. Ayes, 30. Signed, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 148. Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below failed to pass the Senate third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 55, Anti-Discrimination Military Spouses. Ayes, 11. Noes, 19. Signed, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Speaker, the general file for tomorrow is the same list you have right now, starting with House Bill 28, going to House Bill 29. House Bill 40 that was moved earlier is moved down to underneath House Bill 84. And the list stays the same otherwise, and we're going to add the following five bills to the list. House Bill 114, 152, 161, 98, and 153. And with that, Mr. Speaker, I move that the House adjourn until 10 a.m. tomorrow, Tuesday, January 24th, 2017.
Thank you. Committee announcements. Chairman Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 7 will meet tomorrow upon noon recess in H-37 to hear the following three bills: House Bill 165, Acupuncture Practice Act; House Bill 186, Improvement and Service Districts; and House Bill 179, Retail Liquor License Fees.
Chairman Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 in Jonah Room L-54 to consider House Bill 136, Campus Carry.
Chairman Northrop.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee, Education Number 4, will meet tonight upon adjournment. We're going to discuss four bills, House Bill 139, School Finance Court Ordered Placement. House Bill 159, Homeless Minors. And House Bill 189, Higher Education Non-Resident Tuition. After which, we will take up the Omnibus Education Funding Bill and vote to sponsor it as a House Education Bill.
Okay, Vice Chair Halverson. Vice Chair Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet upon adjournment in a few minutes to discuss two bills, House Bill 156, Involuntary Commitment, Emergency Detention Amendments, and House Bill 164, Professional Licensing Boards, Telemedicine, Telehealth. In addition, we will be hearing from the Department of Family Services.
Vice Chair Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 5, Agriculture, will meet tomorrow at 8 a.m. in H-36 to discuss House Bill 24, Water Commission Duties, and House Bill 47, Water Right Procedures. And, folks, if you may have gotten a copy of this paper that said we are meeting upon adjournment tomorrow, that is not correct. We are meeting usual time, 8 a.m., H-36. Thank you.
Vice Chair Hunt, I appreciate you and your committee taking good care of your chairman and the courtesy committee, and so appreciate your concern, and he'll be back shortly. So thank you for your work in his absence. Chairman Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Tomorrow, there's a change in for tomorrow morning for re-referrals. It was set for 8 o'clock to do three bills. That's going to be 9 o'clock, so re-referral of 121, a re-referral for 130, and then House Bill School Facilities Appropriation, 9 o'clock, not 8 o'clock. Then tomorrow at noon recess, we have Community College Capital Construction and Livestock Inspection Investigators. And then also, we didn't finish the Omnibus Water Bill, which is House Bill 86, at noon, so we're going to do that on adjournment in case anyone that, and that's just a re-referral. So, thank you.
Okay, any other announcements? Any other announcements? You have heard the motion, the majority floor leader's motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. The House is adjourned until Tuesday, January 24th at 10 a.m.